Thank you all for coming. This is a full house, and that's awesome. And speaking of awesome, I want to thank my awesome wife, Issa, for having such an amazing mom and for having such an amazing dad who's got this lecture series going. And thanks to ACES for giving it a home. It's been wonderful and will continue to be wonderful. And our speaker tonight, Jason Mark, speaking of journalists, is a journalist of the First Order. And he's probably the only person to have a degree in political science from Georgetown and another degree in horticultural science from UC Santa Cruz. And you'll see how that works when he gets up here, because it works very well. He was the editor of the Earth Island Journal, which is the publishing arm of the Earth Island Institute in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he currently resides, and is currently the editor of Sierra Magazine, which you all should check out if you haven't. It's a really amazing quarterly?
6 times a year.
Bi-monthly, excuse me. Earth Island was quarterly. And it's just wonderful. And he recently published a book called Satellites in the High Country, Searching for Wild in the Age of Man. And this book is spectacular. It raises all kinds of issues about what wild means and our role on this planet. And he does this in a way that's very generous to other people's voices and incredibly thoughtful. And as you're reading, it's one of the few books that as you're reading, you can feel his wheels turning, and it makes you want to turn the pages as his mind is turning before you. It's simply a great read. And I want to thank Island Press for publishing this book. Island Press, the great publisher of environmental books, and Chuck Savitt, who ran Island Press for 30 years and just stepped down, is here tonight. So thank you, Chuck, for this and so many other great books. But Jason, thank you so much for being here tonight. We really look forward to hearing what you have to say. So please come say it. Please welcome Jason Mark.
There we go. Well, many thanks, first of all, to Daniel and to Issa for the invitation. I really, really appreciate it. Thanks to Chris and all the folks at ACES for pulling this together, especially Chris Lane and Amanda Boyle, who did all the legwork to make it happen. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, and my parents' idea of a good time or a summer vacation was driving around Colorado in circles with my sister and I crammed in the car listening to John Denver on the 8-track in the yellow Volvo. I'm just old enough to remember John Denver on the 8-track. And so I've got fond memories of Colorado. It's always great to be back, and thank you all for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. So when I started Satellites in the High Country, I got a really good piece of advice from my editor, Barbara Dean, who along with Chuck Savitz was one of the founders of Island Press, and I had the great honor to be, I think, her second to last book in a 30-year-long editing career. And Barbara said, every good nonfiction book starts with a question. So here's mine. Is there anything on Earth that's still really, truly wild? Right, on a planet with 7 billion people, with our footprint growing ever larger, with things like global climate change, can you find anything that's still really, truly wild in the 21st century? With things like Google Trek, you can now virtually raft down the Colorado River. You can virtually hike the Bright Angel Trail into the Grand Canyon. With the kind of constant connectivity that Chris was talking about, is there still any blank spot on the map, to borrow a line from Aldo Leopold? Can you really get away? And a growing number of folks in the earth sciences would say no, that in fact there isn't anything that's still wild. That, to quote one prominent conservation biologist, wilderness is dead. To use the words from the late political scientist Stephen Meyer, who wrote in his bleak monograph, The End of the Wild, we're going to have to give up our romantic love affair with the wild for the cold light of the necropsy. So that's either a hard-headed or a hard-hearted philosopher, right, saying that, well, wild and wilderness is dead. But I don't think this is just an academic question. I don't think it's a question just for those who are in the earth sciences. Because how we answer that question about whether, in fact, there is still something wild on this planet, and if there is still wilderness, and how we keep that in our lives, that is going to influence how and whether we are able to create a conservation movement that, frankly, is going to look a lot different from the folks in this room, right? How are we going to create a conservation movement that reflects the emerging American majority? And how are we going to make sure that those foundational conservation values that drove so many of the great achievements of 20th century American conservationism, how are they going to remain relevant to these young men who I went mountaineering with in the Gore Range in the Eagle Nest Wilderness a couple of years ago for the book? So to answer that question, I went to some of the most rugged and remote places in the U.S. I went to the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico to track gray wolves. I went, did I skip a slide there? Went and learned how to make fire at a primitive skills camp with, this is Lynx Vilden, at her primitive living wild camp in the Cascades. Went and hung out with the Ogallala Lakota in the Badlands of South Dakota and Wyoming to dive into indigenous Native American worldviews around wilderness and wildness. And what I found, it really surprised me. And I think and I hope that it will surprise you too. One of the most exciting adventures I got to take for this book was river rafting through the Aitchilik River in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. This is a sensitive little clicker here. The Arctic, right, it's like a bold-faced name of global wilderness, right? It's kind of up there with the Sahara or the Amazon or the jungles of Papua New Guinea as a place that is still really untamed and wild. I went there with, this is before I started working with the Sierra Club, I went there with Michael Brune, the head of the Sierra Club, a woman named Rue Mapp from a great group called Outdoor Afro, a wonderful character named DJ Spooky, who is this kind of hip-hop impresario whose idea of casual conversation is talking about the literary theory of James Joyce and James Baldwin. And we spent 5 days rafting down the Aitchilik River until we got to the shores of the Arctic Ocean. I'm going to share with you a little reading from the book about what we found when we got to the Arctic Ocean. We were on our last day of river paddling. As the Aitchilik approached the ocean, the river split into a dozen different braids, and we kept getting stuck on the gravel shoals, forcing us to climb out of the rafts, slog through the shallows, and then push off again into the mainstream. In some places, huge chunks of the riverbank had collapsed into the water, leaving the earth turned sideways, the wildflowers growing perpendicular to the sky. The caribou had disappeared, but now the air was full of birds. We saw many pairs of jaegers, long-tailed and sharp-winged, like gulls with style. At the river's mouth, we stopped to inspect the ruins of an Inupiaq village. Thick beams of wood were melting into the turf. Flowers covered the remains of an iron stove, the line between nature and culture dissolving once more. An Arctic owl, giant, snow-white, watched us impassively. Then the final push. Battling the currents, we paddled across a broad lagoon until we arrived at a spot on the map marked as Icy Reef. It was a long, thin stretch of sand and gravel wedged between the lagoon and the sea. The ocean was perfectly calm, the water gunmetal blue and dotted with small icebergs that had half melted into weird, twisted shapes. Driftwood covered the strand, great piles of bone-white timber that had sloughed off the forests of Canada and Alaska and washed to the sea. A pair of terns guarded this strange kingdom, and they dive-bombed whenever anyone got too close to their nest. Looking down the beach, I spotted something out of place, a bright blue square about 100 yards away. Shirley and I walked down the sand to inspect. As we got closer and realized what we were seeing, shock walloped us. It was a large plastic cooler on wheels with a white plastic handle for towing and the words Polar Roller emblazoned on the side. Foam insulation was coming out of the inside, and the cooler was covered in pockmarks as if someone had attacked it with an ice pick. More likely, a polar bear had used the Polar Roller as a chew toy. And so it's come to this. Even at the ends of Earth, you find yourself reduced to a beach cleanup. So, right, we spend 5 days in this kind of epic, bold-faced name of global wilderness. We get to the Arctic Ocean. It's like the end of the Earth, and we find trash there. Of course, if you go to the Arctic Ocean with the head of the Sierra Club, and you find trash there, you do have to convince the bush pilot to put it in the plane. We're like, dude, you have to put this thing in the plane. And it was just this very clear example of how we live on a post-pristine planet, how there really is no place that's totally untouched. And for me, it was kind of a perfect symbol for how we live now in what some are calling the Anthropocene. So if you haven't heard this term yet, you probably will. This is the idea that, right, as geologists explain it, we've spent the entirety of human civilization is what's called the Holocene, right, since the end of the last ice age. Earth scientists are now saying we have entered a new geologic epoch, the Anthropocene, because we are now the greatest evolutionary force on the planet, and we are shifting the course of evolution more than any other single force. There's a very good chance that you will open up the newspaper sometime in the next year and that you will see a headline saying geologists declare new epoch. It's not really a matter of if, it's now a matter of when if you kind of follow the earth sciences. I'll admit it's kind of hard to know what to make of such a big idea, right? I mean, at the very least, it seems in bad taste. It's kind of like two parts hubris to three parts chutzpah to name an entire epic after yourself. Or it's maybe like the colonialist habit of wrecking a place, then naming it after yourself. It's like the planetary version of Rhodesia. At the same time, though, it's hard to quibble with the facts of our constant domestication. This is a field all of greenhouses in southern Spain, right? The entire valley just carpeted with industrial greenhouses. You know, my heart rebels at the idea of the Anthropocene, but my head has a hard time arguing with it when you see things like this. We're shaping much of the world's ice-free landmass. We're obviously changing the chemistry of the entire oceans through global climate change and all the carbon we're putting in the oceans. Changing the chemistry of the atmosphere, again, through climate change and through our industrial effluent. In my lifetime, I'm 41 years old, in my lifetime, half of the world's wildlife has been destroyed by human activities. This here is a bluefin tuna fish market in Tokyo. So we are clearly diminishing the richness of the planet. We've even created our own rock. This is called plastagglomerate. This is when coral fuses with lava and plastic to create a new rock. So yes, I do think we live in the Anthropocene. We live in kind of a post-natural world. And the question then for me, and the question I investigate in Satellites in the High Country is, well then where does wildness and wilderness fit? Because even when we're acting right with the best of intentions, we're doing a lot of heavy-handed management, right? Here, for example, this is the mouth of the Columbia River, where U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents routinely haze sea lions to prevent them from eating endangered or threatened steelhead or salmon. It's not a bad call, right? The salmon and the steelhead are in real trouble, especially with rising water temperatures on the Pacific Northwest rivers. But it's a tough choice, right? Do you want to haze, sometimes using deadly force, against the sea lions to protect the fish? Here's a barred owl shot and killed by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents to protect the smaller spotted owl. I mean, that's nothing less than kind of a conservationist Sophie's choice. Which owl do you want to save? It's kind of a Hobson's choice, right? It's a choice where there's no choice at all. And even in our wilderness areas, often federal agencies are engaging in heavy-handed management, right? Using Roundup to spray for knapweed and other weeds in the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return. Sometimes dropping lime into rivers to change pH, right? To help aquatic invertebrates and other fish. So it's hard to say, right? Which of our interventions are virtuous and which are less than virtuous. And this really became apparent to me on another adventure I took for the book when I went to the Gila Wilderness of New Mexico to track the Mexican wolf. So this is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service camera trap photo of the Mexican wolf. And a lot of folks in this room will probably know the story of the gray wolf, right? Famously reintroduced to Yellowstone, and then from there has spread throughout much of the Mountain West, has become this kind of incredible flashpoint for how we think about nature. And this is, again, the Rocky Mountains wolf, smaller, more endangered southern cousin. And the wolf, right, is such a great example for how we think about wildness in nature, because it's always been this flashpoint. You know, for environmentalists, it's been this kind of totem of wildness. Adolf Murray, who was a famous 20th century conservationist, said that the wolf's howl was the voice of the wilderness. And the poet and wildness aficionado Gary Snyder said that having predators on the landscape is ecology on the level where it counts. And yet you could also see, you know, that great outdoorsman, Teddy Roosevelt, scorned the wolf as the beast of waste and desolation. Okay, so it's this animal that we've kind of always projected our own ideas of wild nature onto. And obviously the reintroduction efforts have been very controversial. Here's a wolf reintroduction sign in the Gila. Gila residents exercising their Second Amendment rights to express their displeasure at wolf reintroduction. And in fact, the number one cause of wolf mortality in the Southwest is illegal poaching, is being killed by hunters who are not supposed to shoot it because, of course, it is on the endangered species list. And what I found so interesting about this is, again, this is happening. This animal is so highly controlled. So there's an animal with, you can see, both a radio collar as well as ID tags in its ears. So when I went to the Gila, right now, the last census, there's 106 wolves in the greater Gila of New Mexico and Arizona. 106 wolves, and they are probably the most monitored and controlled wildlife on the planet. So a majority of them have radio collars or GPS collars. Most of them, almost all of them, have some sort of pit tag, either a tag in their ears or one underneath their skin, same kind of tag that many people implant in your domestic dogs and cats. It's got a little social security-like number, as well as information on, you know, vaccination history, when it was born, et cetera. So you've got this animal that, in a way, is living in the matrix as much as we are. Here's a shot, actually, by a wolf aficionado. And what's so incredible, this is a member of the pack, I think it's called, I forget which pack this was from. This animal, if it roams too far, if it eats one cow too many, it is likely to then be either translocated, which means that a Fish and Wildlife Service agents come in a helicopter, dart it, pick it up, remove it from the wild, put it someplace else and relocate it, or removed from the wild for good, or in some cases, shot and killed. Okay, so here's a wild animal living inside a giant box it doesn't know exists. Again, another kind of clear example of the kind of the idiocies and the ironies of wildness and wilderness in the Anthropocene, right? Where do you sort of draw the line and say, is this animal wild? Well, it's kind of clearly wild in one sense, right? It's out on the landscape. It's doing what it does. It eats deer and it eats elk and sometimes it eats cattle. And yet it's so controlled and monitored. And what I found so interesting about this is that's happening in America's first legal wilderness, in the Gila Wilderness, established in 1924 by Aldo Leopold, 40 years before the passage of the Wilderness Act. This is a large, unbroken landscape that when you get out there does still feel incredibly untamed. And I'll share a little taste of what the Gila is like. The Gila is sometimes referred to as the Yellowstone of the Southwest, and the big, mostly uninterrupted space is an ideal wildlife haven. On the plains of St. Augustine, I've seen herds of pronghorn bounding across the great sea of grass beneath a rain-shredded sky. Tens of thousands of elk and deer graze the woodlands. There are javelina, fox, coati, and bighorn sheep. Beaver are still found along the Gila River, where needle-like spires rise above sycamore stands. In the springtime, the woodlands are filled with pinyon jays and mountain bluebirds. And when the sun dips past the last ridges, the canyon tree frogs begin their all-night trilling, and a flawless firmament appears. I've never seen such stars. The night's so pure, the sky has its own texture, and the stars appear hung in three dimensions. Crystals drop into a net of dark matter. The Gila Wilderness is one of the last places in the continental U.S. big enough and wild enough where even someone with a good bit of woodcraft can go astray. Few people make it out that far, and the trails are barely used. Many of the paths are little more than faded cow tracks or game trails that peter out into underbrush. Stop, listen, and an awesome stillness arrives, as if someone took the quiet dial and turned it all the way to zero. There's just red rock and gold gramma grass and the twisted shapes of dogged juniper. For a desert kid like me, the Gila is heaven on earth. So I spent the better part of a week in the Gila with former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service scientist who had actually started the Wolf Reintroduction Program, then Dave Parsons, some folks from Center for Biological Diversity and Defenders of Wildlife, trying to find and locate some Mexican gray wolves. And we posted up for a number of days at a place called Cooney Prairie, which has got a number of large elk herds at it. And our idea, of course, being we'll go find the elk herds and the animals will hopefully, and then the wolves will hopefully be after stalking the elk. And I knew it was kind of a fool's errand, right? I mean, you're going into this vast wilderness trying to find one of these 106 wolves. And then, incredibly, on our third night out there, we heard wolf howls in the middle of the night. And we wake up the next morning, and we find wolf tracks not more than 30 yards from our tents. Dave Parsons, the former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service scientist, said we should all go out and buy lottery tickets. Our luck was that good. So here we find these tracks clearly stamped into the red dust of a Forest Service road. But the next question is, well, this is a Fish and Wildlife Service photo. Are the wolves free? Okay, we know they're wild, but are they free? Because everyone knows that even though there's a kind of 106 known wolves in the government program, everybody, the ranchers who hate the wolves, the enviros who love the wolves, and the government scientists in between, know that there's some more out there, that there are some wolves uncollared and kind of outside of the program. And that's what we all wanted. We all wanted for the wolves to not be in the matrix, right? To not be inside the government program. So a few days later, another guy that we were on the trip with actually had the chance to go up with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents who do a weekly flyover, six hours crossing the country, crossing that territory, just listening for the radio signals. We told them to play dumb because we don't want the government to really know if the wolves are out there either, because everybody wanted them to sort of be truly free. He kind of plays dumb. Hey, will you show me where Cooney Prairie is? Oh, there's Cooney Prairie. And when he lands, in fact, there had been no signals within like 25 miles of Cooney Prairie. And it was this amazing moment, right? It felt to me it was like the end of Jurassic Park, right? When the dinosaurs get out. You know, life somehow just finding a way to slip outside the fence. And it was a wonderful relief to know that in spite of everything, despite all of our controls and manipulations, those wolves howling in the night in the middle of the desert wilderness were not only wild, but also free. Which kind of brings me back to the Arctic, right? This is a picture of us in the Arctic. This is a couple days before we got to the Arctic Ocean. So is the Arctic, even the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is it pristine? No, there's trash on the beach there. But is it wild? Definitely. And this is the key thing to remember today here in this human age, is that wild doesn't, and it never has, if you go back into the etymology, if you really go back, I actually did, I kind of geeked out and got the Oxford English Dictionary and got out the little magnifying glass and looked up the definition. It's never meant pristine. What it means is uncontrolled and unmanipulated, because there's a world of difference between accident and intention. There's a big difference between that piece of plastic washing up on the beach and us deciding, say, to drill for oil in the middle of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's the difference, in a sense, the difference between accident and intention is the difference between, well, manslaughter and murder. I mean, the law recognizes a difference with intention. And that's how we can hold on to wildness today, even in a post-pristine world, is to keep some places deliberately free of our manipulations and free of our intentions, and saying in this place, no matter kind of how big or how small it is, we're just going to let nature unfold and we're just going to let the dice roll. And so, in short, what I've been meaning to say is this, is that I think if anything, it's time to double down on wildness as a touchstone for our relationship with the rest of wild nature, with the rest of non-human nature. That in the Anthropocene, in this human age, it's not that wilderness is obsolete. It's, in fact, it's more important than ever, because it allows us, again, to have those places where we are making the choice through forbearance, through generosity, to keep our hands off and to say that this place is going to be for other forms of life with whom we're sharing this planet. I mean, we live in a market economy. Everything becomes more valuable as it becomes more scarce. I can't see any reason why wilderness and wildness should be any different, that it should become more important to us today. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. There are biological reasons. This is a herd of caribou that I took a photo of up on the Arctic tundra. We're going to need these wild places, these big intact landscapes, as a biological, ecological laboratory, just to have some baseline against which to measure all of our other many experiments in domestication. I want to make sure I'm clear. Yes, much of the rest of the world is going to remain a domesticated landscape of cities and suburbs and farms and aquaculture pens, etc. But there are some places that we should set aside. Again, if nothing else, to have that sort of base datum of what a functioning, non-human manipulated landscape looks like. Because when you put evolution into the mix and you start thinking about it that way, then that famous dictum from Thoreau, in wildness is the preservation of the world, it actually takes on a new meaning. It's in wildness is the perpetuation of the world. It's us allowing evolution to continue to unspool as it always has without us putting our thumb on the scale deliberately. I think we're going to continue to need wildness and wilderness for psychological, or I'll even go so far as to say spiritual reasons, just as a place where we can kind of take a little bit of a psychic breather. Here's me and my friend Rue Mapp from Outdoor Afro checking out those caribou. Just to know that there's some place that's away and apart. I think we want that. We want to know that there is some place beyond the edge of the map. There might not be any blank spaces on the map, but you can still get away from civilization. I think we've got a craving and a need for that. I think we're going to, and that gets into a larger point of kind of our then moral responsibilities to the rest of non-human nature. I think the going into the wilderness, and those of you, and I know many of you are in this room, who have gone into the deep backcountry, when you're out there, you know, the common thing to say is, oh, God, it makes me feel small. Well, maybe it's just that you're right-sized, right? That you're kind of actually put back in accurate perspective, which is to remember that there's all these other forms of life out there, and that we need the wilderness sort of as a moral reminder that it's not our responsibility, much less our duty, to garden all of the planet. The esteemed Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson has said, you know, maybe instead of the Anthropocene, what we should call it is the Era Mesozoic, which I understand, I guess, is Greek or Latin, I should look it up, for the Age of Loneliness. Because if we do find ourselves on a planet that where we have domesticated everything, then that's what we're going to be. We are going to be sort of in a planet where it's just sort of us, where every time we look at a landscape, we're going to in some way see a reflection of our own needs and our own appetites. And that essentially would leave us in a kind of a planetary hall of mirrors. Or another way of looking at it is kind of in solitary confinement. And you know what happens to people who are put in solitary confinement? They go insane. And so I think we want to avoid domesticating or gardening the entire world, just from a moral perspective. And finally, and this is coming back to the young men that I shadowed on an Outward Bound trip, I think especially, and Chris was talking about this, especially in this age of near constant connectivity, we're going to need wildness and wilderness and disconnected spaces for new civic reasons. That it's important just to have some places where you can kind of where you can drop offline if you want to, that there's a real political good, a civic good in that. And that if we lose that, I think we'll really come to regret it. And so I'm just going to share one last reading from the book. And I guess I want to share why it connects to these kids, because as net natives, like they've never really known a place that's disconnected. And that was the hardest thing for most of them on that Outward Bound course. And the naturalist staff who work at ACES and who do so much great work getting young kids out in wild nature, I know that's among their biggest challenges, right, is getting the kids to put down the phone, getting them just to engage in a real visceral way. That's true of just about every outdoor educator I have met. That's the biggest challenge. And it's a challenge that I think we need to run at head on and say there should be some places where you can't pick up a signal. Why? Well, I'm gonna share one last reading from the book. In America, the persistence of places beyond the axe and the plow has contributed to a culture of liberty. Freedom requires not just openness, but also capaciousness. A sense of the world is large and wide. The wild is a guarantor of liberty because it serves as an actual physical escape. This ability to get away has been an essential part of the American experience. In U.S. history, the wilderness has been the last resort for the apostate, the nonconformist, and the fugitive slave. Empty, wild country gave Crazy Horse a place to go off alone and find the vision to lead his people. Here now in the Anthropocene, all-encompassing and all-consuming, and therefore with a certain totalitarian vibe about it, the wild's civic value may be its most important virtue. As a political necessity, we need to keep some places outside the reach of our awesome new technologies. Big data in the backcountry? No thanks. Wi-Fi in the woods? I think I'll pass. Because if we ever succeed in knitting all or even most of the physical world into the internet, we could end up abolishing the sense of the away. And we need the away as a political good as well as a psychological one. We need to defend the wild then, because in an otherwise programmed and micromanaged society, it remains one of the last bastions of unpredictability. For now, the wild remains an oasis of anonymity in a world in which we are constantly tagged, pegged, and followed with digital breadcrumbs. In this era of NASA's PRISM and the constant tracking of big data, having a few places that are disconnected and unmonitored seems more valuable than ever. And so, among its many other tasks, the 21st century conservation movement will have to commit to maintaining the wilderness offline as a place where citizens can walk unwatched. Thoreau understood all of this back when the telegraph and the railroad were novelties. His essay, Walking, begins, "I wish to speak a word for nature, for absolute freedom and wildness, as I can't help but emphasize." The essay, remember, is a celebration of the saunter, to stroll without destination or direction. To have the space to saunter is to be free. When I think about the wilderness as a civic good, Thoreau's famous dictum, "In wildness is the preservation of the world," takes on yet another layer of meaning. Perhaps it wasn't written by Thoreau the naturalist or Thoreau the poet. Perhaps instead it was written by Thoreau the tax resister, the political philosopher, the dissident. As I was writing the book, I got another good piece of advice from a friend and something of a mentor, a guy named Mark Herzegaard, who's an environmental writer and journalist. And Mark said, he's like, "Man, why do it?" He's like, "It's so much work to do a book, and like, even if, you know, it gets a pretty good reception, like, you know, all things being equal, in a country of 300 million people, like a small number of people are really going to read it. Why do it?" And he was saying this to be encouraging, right? Not to be a jerk, just kind of say, you need to get straight about your own intentions if you're gonna do all this. And my answer for him was that I really did want, in some sense, for this to be, yes, to start a conversation, a continue a conversation that's already happening, but in a real sense, to be, I guess, what I would call a movement book. And to provide the folks, the advocates, the activists, the conservationists, the environmentalists, the tree huggers, whatever folks might want to call themselves, a little bit of intellectual ammunition and hopefully a dose of inspiration to continue the work that they, in which I know I feel confident in saying that you all in this room in your own ways are doing. And I hope I've been able to do a little bit of that this evening. So this is called a dialogue. It'd be much more fun to have a dialogue than a monologue. And I know we've got some time for questions. Please do use the mic, because this is taped for Aspen Public Radio or live. So thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your presentation today and for the time to write the book. My name is Rachel Richards. I'm a Pitkin County Commissioner here. And one of my great concerns is this reinvigorated and well-funded campaign going across our country to return the public lands, the federal public lands, to the states. And the states, of course, are really looking at, boy, we could develop this, we could extract this, we could do whatever we want and help pay our bills without raising taxes. And this is gaining a lot of momentum at the Colorado Association of Ski Towns, Colorado Association of Counties. Just 3 weeks ago, I present a resolution to oppose the transfer of federal lands to the states. And 25 counties voted against that. Only 14 voted for it because they're open to the idea that we should start taking back these forests and monetizing them. So I don't know if you have any comments on that issue or for
I mean, it's obvious. Thank you, Rachel, for that. And thank you for your leadership on the issue. I don't want to be pedantic, but I just want to correct one thing you said. You said return the public. So it's not a return. So the federal lands in the West were never controlled by the states. They were always federal lands. So let's be careful because this would not be a return of federal lands. This would actually be a handover or, again, as you put it, a transfer. And yeah, it's a dangerous idea. Obviously, it becomes a very dangerous idea when you see what the Bundy gang and the Bundy clan and the kind of their antics earlier this year. It's a big issue, and it's not going. We actually have an article about it in the current issue of Sierra Magazine. And as you point out, it's not just. It's easy to make fun of the Bundy gang, right? But this is actually a large kind of sagebrush rebellion 2.0 that is happening across the West, and especially the Mountain West, and something that we have to vigorously fight against because these are public lands, and they belong to all of us. And yes, obviously local communities have a very large stake in how public lands are managed, but the sagebrush country of Wyoming or the desert country of Utah do not just belong to Wyoming folks and Utah folks. They belong to all of us. Those are common assets held in a public trust, essentially, by all of us. So I want to thank you for pushing back on it, and I hope people will keep an ear to the ground and not blithely kind of dismiss it, because I do think it's happening, and it's obviously well-funded. There's a lot of dark money funding it, and we need to be careful that those public lands, again, are held in common by all of us, and that means being held and stewarded by our federal land management agencies. It's kind of like Donahue style. Someone's gonna run over and hand you the mic. I'll fill the airtime with just banter for people who are driving on the 82 in between up and down the valley. Just keep your eye on the road.
Hi, I'm Dee Malone. I'm the wildlife team chair for the Rocky Mountain chapter of the Sierra Club. We have a campaign to restore wolves to Colorado. A lot of the pushback that I get from those that are opposed say there's not enough land in Colorado. There's too many people. There's no more wilderness left. Could I have a response?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one of the interesting things, and I wrote an article, I guess it was earlier this year, and worked with our NPR affiliate in Northern California to work on a story about reintroducing the grizzly bear to California. It's on our state flag, after all. It seems appropriate that grizzly bears should live there. And a common complaint is, oh, there's too many people in California. And that's kind of the same complaint you're hearing about the wolves. But a study that came out, it was December of 2014, I think in Science, but I'm not entirely sure about that, did a meta study of Europe and found that there are more large carnivores in Europe with twice the population density that we have in the lower 48, right? So there are brown bears within a couple hour drive of Rome. There are wolves in the Pyrenees. There's a great number of wolves in much of Scandinavia. Wolves, bear, lynx have all repopulated much of the Balkans and parts of the former Soviet Union. So that example from Europe, where you actually do have wolves and bears and lynx and these other large carnivores coexisting with a pretty high density human population density, a greater population density than you'd have certainly on the western half of Colorado, or probably Colorado in general, shows that coexistence with carnivores is totally possible. The issue is not the critters. The issue, frankly, is us, right? I mean, the critters are largely just going about their instincts. It's the challenge on us to find what can we change in our land use patterns and our behaviors and the way we perhaps store our food or where we put out the garbage, et cetera, What can we do to minimize and hopefully avoid conflicts and, you know, obviously lethal conflicts? So it's about us using our large brains to figure out a model of coexistence. It's not about driving the predators off the landscape. And I think that European example will hopefully serve as something of a model for how to, yes, reintroduce wolves here in Colorado and Utah, and then hopefully link up the small southwestern population with the threatened but still more or less pretty robust population in the Northern Rockies. So that would be my response to that.
Jason, thanks so much for all your thinking on this. Like you, I share your disconnect between the heart and the mind on the existence of the Anthropocene. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that comes to play around issues of restoration. As Chris mentioned, the organization I worked for partnered with ACES on the prescribed fire just outside of Aspen. Something we thought was a good idea because it was restoring a natural process to the land, but clearly not, you know, the best example of wildness. And I think people, you know, around the country who are managers of wilderness areas and wildlands are struggling with that of, you know, how much gardening do we do, even if it's really well-intentioned in an era of invasive species and global climate change?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. I kind of wanted to somehow find a way to do a fire chapter in the book, and it just didn't shake out that way because fire, especially for us here in the West, is probably kind of the most threatening wild force, right, that we're confronted with. I wish I had a very clear answer for you. I mean, I guess in a way, one example of restoration ecology that does seem clearly virtuous is this idea of rewilding, right? The reintroduction of carnivores on the landscape. Ideally, you know, you wouldn't. I think the problem with what's going on in the Southwest is it's at once half-assed and heavy-handed, right? It's like the worst of both worlds. The federal agencies have kind of botched the whole thing. So in an ideal world, you kind of be able to let the animals back out on the landscape, let them do their thing, and then they are still wild. Fire is obviously a much tougher call. I think certainly in wilderness areas and in the large national forest areas, the state and federal agencies need to let more burns just go and to restore fire on the landscape. I mean, that's kind of one way of doing it. We saw that a little bit last summer in Washington. Washington had very bad fires, and the state forestry department there and firefighting department there decided to let some burns go much longer and farther than they would have otherwise, as long as they weren't endangering human lives. If they were endangering property, they still let them go. That was a tough call to make, obviously, if you're a homeowner, but that's what they thought kind of the best science and, frankly, kind of the manpower called for. And that's actually what they do in Australia, which is also a fire-prone landscape. It's a totally different model in Australia of how they fight fires, and a lot more onus is put on landowners to either evacuate or stay and defend. And there are some agencies that are looking at that Australian model of saying maybe we should treat fire differently. But again, I recognize that's a tough call. For prescribed burns, I mean, that gets into a whole conversation, and we're going to run out of time here tonight, of yes, fire's always been a force on the landscape, and not just natural fire, but of course anthropogenic or human-caused fire. Pre-Columbian societies across the continent were using fire to shape the landscape, often in profound ways. That puts another wrinkle in this question about kind of gardening in wildness. And I guess my short answer there is, for the most part, most indigenous societies, while they were shaping the landscape, they were still allowing most natural processes to continue to unfold. And while that might not exactly be a perfect model for an industrial society of 300 million people, it does offer a different way of thinking about things. Like, how can we let most natural processes continue to unfold? I recognize it was kind of a rambling answer, but hopefully it got at some of what you wanted to know. Yes, ma'am. She's coming around.
Thank you. There's a movement afoot that I've just been learning about of trying to connect the designated refuges and wild areas that are isolated And they're becoming almost like a zoo, just it's a larger version of that. And there's some really interesting discussions by Wilderness Workshop, who the last questioner works with. Do you think that prospect is possible so that between Canada, the lower Arctic, and all the way down to Mexico, to start connecting these up so that these animals can move? Because, I mean, what's the square mileage for one of these Mexican wolves for one little pack? It must be hundreds and hundreds of square miles.
Yeah, if they didn't have, you know, interstates to cross, their natural range would be quite large. And again, you know, we saw just last year, last 18 months, a wolf get all the way from the Northern Rockies to the north rim of the Grand Canyon. So, yes, connectivity is key, and I think connectivity is probably the obviously kind of next major challenge for the conservation movement in the era of climate change. Because we know things are going to want to move upward in altitude, they're going to want to move upslope and northward in general, or poleward, I should say. And the only way they can do that, they can't do that if our conservation areas are isolated islands. And so it's essential that we create these corridors of connectivity for critters to be able to move. And the challenge there is it's not just going to be able to be public lands. It's going to have to be a mix of federal lands, state lands, county lands, and private lands that are either A, put into conservancies, or B, working with enlightened farmers and ranchers to think about wildlife corridors on their properties. That's the only way to create the linkages. But the mapping's been done. Another great Island Press author named John Davis did a book with Island Press, whose name I'm forgetting. But he did these treks both on the East Coast, mostly along the Appalachians, and in the West, mostly following the Continental Divide, showing how, yes, you could, in theory, knit together these large continent-scale north-south wildlife corridors. So it's essential, and again, I think the trick is going to be enlisting the private landowners to either, again, put lands in conservancies or for ranching interests to kind of farm with the wild or ranch with the wild, you know, maintaining riparian corridors, maintaining other corridors along their properties. So that's the big task ahead of us. Yes, sir. I think we'll do one more. Yes, ma'am. Right here in the, we'll go right there.
One of the challenges that thinking deeply about the wild and allowing wild into this for any wildlife manager is this the fact of extinction. And if you're advocating hands off and allowing wild, are you also advocating allowing extinctions, and how do you feel about extinction?
That is the toughest question around this whole thing. So yes, I think, and I totally recognize that this is a hard case to make, that in some wilderness areas, we're going to have to adopt a totally hands-off model. And that would hopefully not lead to extinctions, but would perhaps lead to local extirpations, for sure. And I do not in any way belittle, you know, what a tough call that is to make, and a tough call because we're in an extinction crisis. And I also want to make clear, you know, that point of view is not that well, that point of view that I've articulated is not that well received by some people in the conservation biology community. I quote a guy in the book named Stuart Pym. He's an eminent ornithologist at Duke University, and he's like, where's your wildness meter? You know, he's like, forget it. We're in an extinction crisis. We can't futz around with these aesthetic, spiritual values, these moral values. We just need to save everything we can. Yes, I take a different point of view that in some places and in some times, we need to kind of take a completely hands-off point of view. Again, for some biological, scientific reasons, but again, also for moral, aesthetic, and political ones. But yeah, it's a tough call. And this is our last one right here.
Hi, I am wondering if you think that places where there is not digital connectivity is a new definition of wilderness, and is there any movement for conservation of analog wilderness?
There's not a movement for conservation of analog wilderness, but you should be its ED. And I look forward to being involved in that. No, there's not really a movement for that. Although it's on people's radar screens for sure. I had the opportunity for the book to interview John Jarvis, who's the longtime head of the National Park Service, and it is definitely on the Park Service's radar. They're balancing, and they actually kind of got thrown into the deep end of the pool after Parks Canada, our neighbors to the north, decided, oh, we're going to start doing Wi-Fi in all the parks. There was a big uproar in Canada around that, and then the Park Service was like, whoa, we need to figure this out. And so when I talked to Director Jarvis in, I guess it's now going on about two, I talked to him about 2 years ago exactly for the book, he was kind of torn. He was leaning towards where the agency was going to go was connectivity in the front country, in the visitor centers. And that makes sense, right? You do want to kind of be able to come back and share all these images and share them with your friends and family, but trying as much as possible to keep the back country offline. He also recognized that it's not totally in his hands. Yes, the Wilderness Act would prevent, say, a cell phone tower in a designated wilderness, but if you're one ridgeline over, that signal's going to get in. And any folks here who are, you know, backcountry skiers or backpackers or mountaineers, you get five bars on these 14ers. I mean, I've seen it. You know, you're out there and you get in the mountain valleys. No, you get in the mountain valleys, you don't get a signal. But if you're on top of the peaks, you can often get a very good signal. So there's not that movement. But again, I think there should be. And I think at the very least, it's the land management agencies know that it's an issue to grapple with, and hopefully folks will continue. There's always, right, the option to just, like, say no, right, and just not bring the phone, keep it on airplane mode or something the whole time. But I do worry that the lure is there, and I worry kind of for, again, net natives, the lure is, like, too strong. And so it's something that we maybe need to decide collectively. Because it's so hard to exercise individual restraint, we might have to exercise collective forbearance, right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. And on that note, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for coming out on a Tuesday evening. I really appreciate your attention, and keep it up. Take care.